Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and I know we've hit upon a good idea when people here in the studios stop me in the hallway to talk about it. So all this week, we're talking about albums or songs that you missed when they came out, but which you came to love later. And it seems like everyone here has a favorite record that they came to late. And it's not just here. Melody called us while driving out of Detroit back to her farm to tell us her missed it then, love it now story.
So the song for me is Cherry Bomb by The Runaways. At that time, the only music I listened to when that came out was jazz and blues. I loved Billie Holiday. There wasn't anybody bigger for me. Jazz was what I listened to. I married a man 30 years later that lived a life of rock and roll. And one day he talked about Cherry Bomb, and I'd never heard it. And he played it for me, and I couldn't believe it's such a massively awesome song. Existed, and I'd never heard of it. Hello, Daddy. Hello, Mom. Cherry Bomb. Hello, world. I'm your wild girl. Cherry Bomb. That's The Runaways. That's Melody's pick in our feature that we're calling Missed It Then, Love It Now. What did you come to late that turned out to be a real favorite? Tell us your story. You can leave it on our website, soundcheck.org, tweet us at soundcheck, or call us, 866-939-1612. And don't be embarrassed, because even people who are in the business of making and playing music occasionally miss things. Take the pop duo of Tegan and Sarah, for example. They'll tell us in a little while what they missed then and love now, and we'll hear some more of your calls and stories as we head on through the hour. We're also going to make sure you don't miss Anna von Hauswolf's album while it's still new. The Swedish singer and church organist has made a dark but striking album, and will play some of it for us live. Speaking of not missing out, see if you recognize this. Even for Americans who are not into classical music, you might know this tune, Amilcare Ponchielli's 19th Century Dance of the Hours. You might know it because it played a big role in the Disney film Fantasia. But for millions of Americans, this tune will forever be associated with this song.
Hello, mother. Hello, father. Here I am at Camp Granada. Camp is very entertaining, and they say we'll have some fun if it stops raining.
This hit song turned Alan Sherman into a sudden success, and then just as suddenly, he disappeared. A new biography on the song parodist and songwriter takes a look at why. It's called Overweight Sensation, The Life and Comedy of Alan Sherman, and it was written by Mark Cohen, who's on the line with us from the Bay Area in California. Mark, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks.
So give us a thumbnail sketch of who, for people who don't know Alan Sherman, which I guess would be anybody under 40, who is he? Why is he important?
Well, Alan Sherman appeared on the pop music scene as one of the unlikeliest stars that we've had in a long time. In 1962, he released his first album, which was called My Son the Folk Singer. And that was during the folk music revival that was very popular in the late 50s and early 60s.
So this is like the Kingston Trio or at the top of the charts.
And Peter, Paul, and Mary,
right, right.
And Theodore Bacall and others. And Sherman parodied the American folk song. And the essence of the parody was that in the place of the great heroes of the songs, whether it was a Western song like The Streets of Laredo, a very sad song about a young man who has a duel and doesn't turn out so well,
right,
or the nursery rhyme Frère Jacques, or the great battle hymn of the Republic, Sherman took these songs and inserted the lives of the people he grew up with, who were first-generation American Jews, involved in businesses like the garment industry and selling clothes and so forth. And it turned out to be an unexpected and enormous hit.
Mm-hmm. So My Son the Folk Singer is followed by My Son the Celebrity and finally My Son the Nut, three in a row, 62, 63. At one point, they're all on the Billboard charts. And I mean, just the titles, you know, instead of My Son the Doctor, you know,
it's like... Right, exactly right. Yeah, it was amazing. All three albums went gold. They all appeared within 10 months of one another. The first appeared in October 1962 and My Son the Nut in August 63, or actually very late July. So there were three albums in 10 months, three gold albums,
mm-hmm.
and enormous radio play, chart-topping albums, television appearances, national concert tour. This was really a huge cultural phenomena in 1962-63, in that brief period before the Beatles came to America, before mm-hmm. the 60s of legend and myth that we know today.
Right.
There was this moment that Alan Sherman occupied, and he was enthusiastically welcomed, and no one expected it. It was a very interesting moment.
Well, and he had a number one hit single with Hello Mudda, Hello Fada, you know, based, as I mentioned earlier, on this Ponchielli dance of the hours. And while there wasn't anything specifically Jewish about this song, you know, it becomes this kind of American phenomenon, you know, the kind of spoiled kid sent away to camp who is having a miserable time. Let's listen to a little bit.
And the head coach wants no sissies, so he reads to us from something called Ulysses. Now I don't want this should scare you, but my bunkmate has malaria. You remember Jeffrey Hardy? They're about to organize a searching party. Take me home, oh Mudda Fadda, take me home. I hate Granada, don't leave me out in the forest where I might get eaten by a bear. Take me home, I promise I will not make noise or mess the house with other boys. Oh, please don't make me stay. I've been here one whole day.
Alan Sherman, Hello Mudda, Hello Fada, 1963, number, it peaked at what, number two? It was on the top ten.
As a single, it peaked at number two. The album that held it, the My Son the Nut album, was the number one album in the country for 8 weeks, from late August till mid-October of 63. It shot up the charts. The sales of both the album and the single were extraordinary, and the single not only did well in this country, but even around the world.
Hmm.
It was an amazing response to this song about this kid whose heartbreak at being away from home is treated very comically. I think Sherman tiptoed very brilliantly the line between pathos in this song and comedy, and I think that's part of the secret of its appeal.
And he's been there one whole day. Mark Cohen's my guest, writer, editor, journalist. His new book is called Overweight Sensation, The Life and Comedy of Alan Sherman. We'll get to that title in a moment, but you said nobody expected this. Was this thought of as a kind of specialty recording? It would be, you know, marketed to the Jewish American community and not much else beyond that?
Yes, at the beginning of his career with his first album, that was certainly how he was thought of. There were reports, reviews of the first album in the trade press, Billboard and Variety and so forth. And they said, well, this will do well in New York and Miami and a couple of other places. It's not for the broad public.
Mm-hmm.
When it started selling, and it sold 400,000 copies in 3 weeks, that first album, people realized that something new was happening. And one reviewer, I think, got very, very close to what was going on. He said, this seems to be the release of a long-suppressed general emotion. And that long-suppressed general emotion was the announcement of an ethnic identity among Americans.
Mm.
Just a year later, the famous book Beyond the Melting Pot came out and confirmed for everyone in an academic way that the melting pot had not fully taken place. And Sherman, just 1 year earlier, his success, I think, rested on the same premise.
So even if you weren't Jewish, the concept of that kind of identity, that kind of owning your ethnic identity, was something that would have resonated with other Americans in 1962 and 3.
Yes, very much so. And that was the beginning, of course, of the rise of the tremendous success of Jewish American comedians,
mm-hmm.
from Mel Brooks to Woody Allen and so forth. And we saw with those great careers that their ethnic Jewish identity was no barrier to general success. By the time their fame was well established, that wasn't as surprising as it was in 62 when Sherman did it and succeeded at it.
So was there anything pre-Alan Sherman that would have set the stage, or was he really the first of his kind?
Well, no, there were attempts, and there was definitely signs that this was coming. Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner had produced their first 2,000-Year-Old Man album in 1960, and even a second one the following year. They were critically praised, but did not do well commercially,
mm-hmm.
Despite what I had heard that they had. When I researched it and looked for news of big sales in all the trade publications, there was none to be found.
Mm.
And Jackie Mason was an up-and-coming comedian. He was already on Ed Sullivan and doing well. But the kind of response that Alan Sherman got to singing songs like Sarah Jockman, which was the great radio hit of his first album, that was really something new, that level of broad support.
Let's hear that song. Sarah Jockman is a parody of a tune you will recognize from Alan Sherman.
Hello? Is this 418-9749?
Speaking.
Sarah?
Yeah.
Sarah Jockman, Sarah Jockman, how's by you? How's by you? How's by you to family? How's your sister Emily?
She's nice too.
She's nice too.
Jerry Bachman, Jerry Bachman, so what's new? So what's new?
What you doing, Sarah?
Reading John O'Hara.
He's nice too.
He's nice too.
Sarah Jockman, Sarah Jockman, how's by you? How's by you? How's your brother Bernie?
He's a big attorney.
How's your sister Doris?
Still with William Morris.
How's your cousin Shirley?
She got married early. How's
her daughter? Alan Sherman with Christine Nelson and Sarah Jockman, a surprise hit single for Alan Sherman in 1962. Mark Cohen telling us the story in his new book called Overweight Sensation, The Life and Comedy of Alan Sherman. I mean, just listening to it after all these years, the comedy is based on, like, names.
What Sherman did in that song was really capture a sociological kind of snapshot of American life. He had How's Your Cousin Ida? She's a freedom rider. There was the cousin who works for William Morris, the talent agency. There was Seymour, who joined the Peace Corps. So there was really a very accurate hitting of all the current event buttons that were happening in American life, from the Peace Corps, the Freedom Riders, the Civil Rights Movement, of course. And there's a question about Cousin Rita. She's a regular Lolita. So the coming youth explosion, promiscuity, civil rights, the Peace Corps, show business. There's Bernie, who's a big attorney. It painted a portrait of aspiring, up-and-coming class of Americans who the adults were involved in their professional lives as attorneys or in show business. The youth were following the idealistic mood and trends of the day. And it captured in a comic way a portrait of a life that all Americans could share in. But that, looking back, is no surprise that it grew out of Jewish-American roots, because the Jewish American community was the most well-known for being involved in the civil rights struggle, being involved in show business. So it was a wonderful ability to turn the Jewish experience into a model for the general experience.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay. Mark Cohen, my guest on Soundcheck. His book is called Overweight Sensation, The Life and Comedy of Alan Sherman. And now, Mark, I think I need to ask you about your title, Overweight Sensation. I mean, he was a big guy. He had many big appetites, as you recount in the book.
Yes, he did. He used his own weight in his own comedy, so I didn't feel bad about creating a title like that. One of his greatest songs is "Hail to Thee, Fat Person," where he wrote about his own travails with his weight. And he also recorded some songs that never were released. One of them called "Somewhere Over the Rainbow." He did a parody called "Overweight People." but yes, he was a man of completely unregulated appetites for food, for very unorthodox sexual engagements, liquor. He smoked. He really was not trying to live a very long life. He wasn't a moderate individual in any way. And so the pun occurred to me of overnight sensation and overweight sensation.
Right.
And I think it's fair and funny and hopefully appropriate to the subject in that way.
So he did sort of rocket to overnight success in 1962, had this big moment in 63 when all three records are on the Billboard charts. And then his career goes into this kind of decline, and it's not a long decline because he was quite successful. If his job was, you know, to not lead a long life, he was quite successful at that, dying before his 49th birthday. Was it a change in the mood? Was it a, you know, did the country lose interest in parody for a while, or was he just beset by his own demons?
I don't think it was a loss of interest in parody, because the film careers of both Mel Brooks and Woody Allen were actually built on parodies, but parodying either the Western or the crime caper film. Parody was still very important, but Sherman had kind of accomplished what he had set out to accomplish, and he was left with the problem that many people are left with after they achieve their life's dream, and that is what to do next. And for Sherman, the answer was to give in to his most self-destructive behavior. So the change in the mood of the country in terms of the explosion of rock and roll music, because he was popular not just with the adults, but even with teenage people. That group was stolen away in the rock and roll revolution. And that also changed the mood of the country as well. And he became more conservative as the popular culture became more liberal, and he really undermined his own comic instinct. And that, together with ruining his marriage, and he had a very sad end. He really did. But up until the end, actually, I discovered that he was still writing and producing some interesting comic bits. He was working on a work about golf that he said is going to do for golf what Casey at the Bat did for baseball. And it really was pretty good. It was called The Gospel According to St. Andrews, which was a good title in and of itself.
The famous golf course in Scotland.
Exactly.
So where do we hear the echoes of Alan Sherman's influence?
Well, the most obvious answer, of course, is in Weird Al Yankovic, who's made a career out of song parodies and has been very open about claiming Sherman as an antecedent. But more interestingly is people like Jerry Seinfeld, Larry David, Jason Alexander, that whole Seinfeld gang, Rick Moranis, the comic actor from Ghostbusters, Paul Reiser, the comedian who had the hit show Mad About You. All of these people can be found on the internet or in journalism talking about Sherman and their enjoyment of Sherman. Larry David was invited to be a guest of honor at a Boston Pops concert. He chose to sing Shake Hands with Your Uncle Max by Alan Sherman. Jerry Seinfeld was talking with one of his friends on Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, talking about Alan Sherman. But I think Sherman deserves an enormous recognition for what he clearly did without any question of creating a comic legacy that today I find over and over when I speak with people of a certain generation, the person they refer to as one of their great comic early loves is Alan Sherman. Alan Sherman delivered an intelligent, funny, clever depiction of American life in the early 1960s, whether it was the life of the suburbs in a song like Here's to the Crabgrass, which is still a terrific...
Good title.
great title, and it captures that love-hate affair of city versus suburban living that we still have today. Or him to the great working man in a pun like, he was trampling through the warehouse where the drapes of Roth are stored. That's from the Ballad of Harry Lewis. So there was... It's interesting to remember and to look, and I was very glad to find this in researching the book, that people like Irving Berlin, Johnny Mercer, Richard Rodgers of Rodgers and Hart and Rodgers and Hammerstein took Sherman very, very seriously as a very capable songwriter when he first appeared on the scene. He wasn't considered in any way uncool or doing something that wasn't worthy of tremendous respect. Songwriters who were the greatest of their time took him very seriously, and Rodgers even looked into writing a musical with Sherman as a partner, which was a heck of a compliment. So Sherman, I think, in this 50th summer of Hello Mudda, Hello Fada, is worth a look back and also a chance for us to enjoy ourselves again with his very, very funny songs.
Well, Hello Mudda, Hello Fada celebrates its 50th anniversary in August. The book, though, is out now. It's called Overweight Sensation, The Life and Comedy of Alan Sherman, written by Mark Cohen, who's been my guest on Soundcheck. Mark, thanks very much.
Thank you.
The ballad of a great man of the cloth. His name was Harry Lewis, and he worked for Irving Roth. He died while cutting velvet on a hot July the 4th, but his cloth goes shining on.
Coming up, more of your Better Late Than Never song picks in our Missed It Then, Love It Now project, including a pair of songs from the identical twins Tegan and Sarah. And later, the organist Anna von Hauswolf performs in our studio. This is Soundcheck.
His cloth goes shining.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Time now to check in with our week-long project called Missed It Then, Love It Now. We're building a playlist for this Friday's episode using the songs and albums that you completely missed the first time around but now love. First up, the Canadian-born pop duo Tegan and Sarah Quinn, the identical twin sisters who lead the band, Tegan and Sarah. They joined us earlier this week to record a session in our studio. You're hearing some of it in the background. And we will air that session tomorrow night. You can watch in-studio videos from it at soundcheck.org. But first, here's a preview of our conversation. I asked Tegan and Sarah for their picks for Missed It Then, Love It Now. Sarah first.
it's sort of a little bit of an embarrassing story because, you know, we were fairly tapped in what was happening with music, especially in the late 90s, mid-90s. You know, that was a real heyday for us in our teen years. One of our first major tours in North America was with Ryan Adams. And we got talking one night and he asked us if we were aware of a band called The Replacements. And I had never heard of them before. And he actually ended up gifting us the whole discography, and specifically Let It Be really resonated with me. And I just couldn't believe, like, I mean, this is like music that I couldn't believe that I had never heard it before and that it could
resonate. But in your defense,
so much.
Weren't you like 4 or 5 years old?
I totally was. But even in my teen years, I didn't. Okay, I did miss it for sure the first time, based on the fact that I had been just born. But then I missed it again, I think, when I became interested in that type of music. I said I wouldn't admit this, but the truth is that there's the song Androgynous on the record, right? Androgynous. I did know that song, except I knew it from the Crash Test Dummies because they had covered it and put it on their record. Okay. And so I remember hearing Let It Be and hearing that song and thinking like, oh my God, the Crash Test Dummies didn't write this song. Like, you know, just like real sort of naive, like out of touch Canadian suburban accident.
Well, let's make up for lost time. Here's Sarah's pick, The Replacements.
Here comes Dick, he's wearing a skirt. Here comes Jane, you know she's sporting a chain. Same hair, evolution, same build, evolution. Tomorrow who's gonna fuss? And they love each other so, androgynous. Closer than you know, love each other so, androgynous.
That is The Replacements and Androgynous from the album Let It Be. Sarah missed that one first and second time around, came to it late, fell in love with it. Tegan, what about you?
Well, I have a very similar story, obviously, growing up similarly to Sarah. We had a musical background growing up, and when we became teenagers, we got really into the punk rock and sort of like, you know, indie rock scene in Calgary. My mom would drop us off at gigs on the weekend, and we became obsessed with this Calgary band called Red Autumn Fall. And the lead singer, Simeon Ross, to this day, I still think he's like a handsome, handsome devil with a wonderful voice.
Though you always meant harm,
but I remember I was probably 18 or 19 stumbling upon the Smiths record, The Queen Is Dead, and thinking to myself, these people sound just like Red Autumn Fall. But not thinking like, oh, Red Autumn Fall must have been ripping off the Smiths. I thought I had discovered a new band. And of course, to my horror, finding out it came out like the early, I think it was 86 or 85 or something like that, the record came out. But fantastic record. And in my defense, I will say it wasn't like missing Bowie or something. I mean, my parents were very cool and hip and we grew up listening to a lot of really amazing music. But I think the Smiths, maybe they just missed that a little bit. It was a little younger for them. So, And I feel so excited because I got to like learn about a band that had, you know, an incredible discography, and of course then started following Morrissey religiously as well. So,
but you thought they were taking a page out of
Red Autumn Fall. I was like, poor Red Autumn Fall, no wonder they were never successful. This band, the Smiths, stole their sound.
And if a double-decker bus crashes into us, to die by your side is such a heavenly way to die. And if a
Smiths is Tegan's pick for our Missed It Then, Love It Now feature. You'll get a chance to hear Tegan and Sarah playing in our studio on tomorrow's edition of Soundcheck. Now, Stephen from West Islip, New York, picked the album The Dust of Retreat by Margot and the Nuclear So-and-Sos. Stephen tells us that it came out in 2006 while he was still in high school.
It wasn't until several years after I graduated from high school that my girlfriend at the time put it on my iPod, actually, and I kind of discovered it when I was flipping through.
And don't pick up the phone.
Um, I kind of mulled over it, listened to it a few times, but it was actually, ironically, after we broke up that album really became something that I looked to as inspiration to help me get through that tough time. Particularly the song Dress Me Like a Clown. I absolutely loved that song, and it really kind of exemplified everything that I was struggling through at that point in my life.
But tonight we'll leave all our lovers behind and try to live a quiet life. My love has dressed me like a clown.
Thanks, ex-girlfriend, for helping me to get over you from a song that you gave me.
Well, I got to confess, I missed that one, too. That is Margot and the Nuclear So-and-Sos, and an album that came out in 2006, and the song is called Dress Me Like a Clown. Meant something to Stephen some years later. And as we continue along, our theme is Missed It Then, Love It Now, and joining me on the line is Carolina Gonzalez, the senior producer for Latino USA on NPR and an occasional contributor to Soundcheck as well. And Carolina, you left a story on our website about the Pixies. Is this like...
Yeah, I have a confession to make that's probably going to get my music credit card taken away forever. I did not pay attention to the Pixies. I had heard the name, but did not pay attention to them whatsoever until 1993, when they'd already broken up.
Now, why was that? What were you listening to?
Well, I think what happened is that somewhere around 87 or 89, I'd come out of college, and I'd been very involved in, you know, listening to punk and post-punk and a lot of that stuff. And somewhere around 88 or 89, I just got completely disillusioned with anything that involved guitars and really switched my listening to a lot more world music. And I was thinking a lot about it, writing a lot about it, going to a lot of shows, and I just completely stopped paying attention to anything that was that had to do with guitars and rock and roll from about, I don't know, like I'd say maybe 88, 89 to about, you know, the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And then I moved in to a household where I had a couple of roommates that had, you know, overlapping but very different musical tastes. And one day my Chicano roommate plays Vamos from the Come On Pilgrim, the Pixies' first record. And I'm listening to them say things like chévere and puñeta and all these, you know, Puerto Rican words coming out of somebody who clearly was not a Spanish
speaker.
It was thoroughly charming in exactly the same way that, you know, Joel Strummer singing in Spanish Bombs had completely charmed me.
Mm-hmm. So the Pixies, so when you did discover the Pixies, you went right back to the beginning to Come On Pilgrim.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, and then I went right through everything that they'd done and listened to, like, bootlegs and, you know, performance, live stuff, everything that I could get my hands on. So, yeah, it was like, okay, this is really embarrassing. I can't believe I didn't know about these guys and I hadn't been following them all this time. And now I can't go see them. It was like, wah, wah, they've broken up.
Although they would, of course, come back some years later.
Yes.
But that didn't help you back in 93 when Carolina discovered this record by the Pixies.
Sufrimiento.
Donde no hay sufrimiento.
Me perderon pasa por la calle.
Isla de canto.
Me voy, me voy, me voy.
The Pixies with Isla de Encanta from their album Come On Pilgrim. Carolina, there is some English there, but mostly you were charmed by the attempt at Spanish.
By the sort of, like, grammatically off, but, you know, really engaged use of Spanish.
All right. That's the Pixies. Carolina missed it first time around, loves it now. She's senior producer for Latino USA on NPR. Carolina Gonzalez, good to talk to you again.
Yeah, great to talk to you again, John.
Coming up, the Swedish organist and singer-songwriter Anna von Hausswolf joins us to perform in our studio. But remember, Friday's show will be a crowdsourced playlist from this Missed It Then, Love It Now feature that we're doing. So get your stories in to our website at soundcheck.org or call us at 866-939-1612 or tweet us at soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The organ, the so-called king of instruments, can mean surprisingly different things. Yes, it summons up visions of churches and choirs and sacred rites, but it can also conjure something more sinister. You know, that Phantom of the Opera stuff. The Swedish singer and songwriter Anna von Hausswolf revels in that dichotomy in her latest album called Ceremony. It owes as much to the dark, gothic side of rock as it does to the sacred music of the Scandinavian church. Here, with a live version of her song Sunrise, is Anna von Hausswolf and her band.
Did you know the perfect life? Did you get too much of it? Can you hear the people sigh?
Oh, silver green, good smell.
That's called Sunrise from the Swedish singer and songwriter Anna von Hauswolf, who sang here and is playing for us today in the studio a double manual electric organ, so two keyboards, one atop the other. With Cameron Cooper on electric guitar, we'll hear drummer Michael Stasiak and bassist Quinn Lewington joining in momentarily. But Anna von Hauswolf's most recent album is called Ceremony, and Anna, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hey.
So that it's an extraordinary album. I mean, it's got a very distinctive sound. Many of the songs have a kind of ceremonial or processional kind of quality to it. That was clearly the intention. What was the inspiration for this record?
Actually, I wrote most of the songs when my grandfather passed away, and he was one of my best friends, really. So I was quite sad, and I started to kind of notice things, see things that I usually kind of close my eyes to.
Like what?
No, just you know, the big existential questions mm-hmm. in life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you start to deal with those questions, but more seriously.
Well, there are two epitaphs on the record.
Nature, I think, uh-huh. especially.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. And, you know, the trees in sunrise and that sort of natural imagery. But there's an epitaph for Theodore and an epitaph for Daniel on this record. Is one of those your grandfather?
No, they are my friends, actually. I wrote those two songs for an art project. At that time, kind of fascinated by... like visionary epitaphs, or how would you like your epitaph to look like?
Yeah.
So I did like a small project. I made pictures, and then I made the compositions for their funerals.
While they're still very much with us.
Yes, they are, but they have like everything.
Everything's all set.
Everything is all set.
the album from Anna von Hauswolf is called Ceremony. It's full of this play of light and dark. And, of course, Anna, it's based, you know, the most distinctive sound is your choice of the organ, the church organ, as the main instrument. Did that kind of change the songwriting process, change the way you sing on this record?
Yeah, I think it did, because the church organ takes up a lot of space. So you can hold on to some chords for a longer period of time than what you can when you play the piano. That's what I did before the church organ. So, and I really like that you can add those layers and textures into the songs. So I started to play a little bit more with sounds and what you can do with sound and what you can create with those sounds.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, when you talk about this, you know, listening to the sound and thinking so much about the sound, I am reminded of the music that your father has made over the years, Carl Michael von Hauswolf, whose music often deals with long, extended tones, drones, things like that. I assume his music is something you grew up with.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I'm glad you say that. Yeah.
Well, I mean... He's also a visual artist, and you were talking before about with the epitaphs doing some artwork and stuff. A lot of some of his music also deals with this kind of paranormal stuff. Is that at all a part of your songwriting as well?
Yeah, I think it is, because I'm a very kind of spiritual person. I'm not religious, but I do believe in, you know, everything that science can't prove. I get curious, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say that it doesn't exist. I love ghost stories. I love old houses, and I really love history. And I mean, history is a lot of you know, energy still.
Yeah, and
everyone knows that, you know.
And when you go to a really old church or something, or if you go to an old, you know, Stonehenge or something like that, you kind of feel there's still something there. I don't know. It's weird to say.
Yeah,
but
you do.
You do kind of get
and
that
you can't
feeling.
Explain it.
Yeah.
So I think paranormal forces is a good
good way to explain something.
All right. We're speaking with Anna von Hauswolf, the Swedish singer and songwriter. Her album is called Ceremony. Mountains Crave is the next song. This has gotten a fair amount of attention on the internet. What's this song about?
No, that's the hit.
Yeah, that's the hit single.
That's a hit. It's a song about longing to be connected to something that's naturally a part of you, but that you've taken a distance from.
Okay. You want to play it for us?
Yeah.
All right. Anna von Hauswolf playing the organ and singing, Cameron Cooper on guitar, Michael Stasiak behind our drum kit, and Quinn Lewington playing the bass. You'll find this on Anna's record called Ceremony, but here is a live performance on Soundcheck. Thank you. Anna von Hauswolf, the singer and organist with her song Mountains Crave, live here in the Soundcheck studio today with her band. And let's hear another song. This one is called Liturgy of Light. Once again, you'll find it on Anna's record called Ceremony. Here's a live performance. Liturgy of Light, another live performance from Anna von Hauswolf, the Swedish singer and songwriter. Anna, congratulations on the record, and thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Anna von Hauswolf, the album is called Ceremony. This is Soundcheck.
Thank you.
tomorrow on the show, Tegan and Sarah. You've already heard their picks for our Missed It Then, Love It Now project, which is helping to crowdsource a playlist for our Friday show. Tomorrow, you'll hear Tegan and Sarah performing in the studio. And we'll have a conversation about broadening their appeal on their new record called Heartthrob. We'll also hear from guitarist Glenn Jones, whose music follows in the tradition of the late great American guitarist John Fahey. That's tomorrow. If you like our theme song, check out New York keyboardist Marco Benevento, because he wrote it. It's called Eagle Rock. You can find out more about Marco and his music at soundcheck.org. See you back here tomorrow. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.